This is the Canadian Society of Cinematographers podcast. Join us as Canada's cinematographers discuss the tools and techniques they use in shaping the aesthetics of their current projects.
Here we are, weeks after your return from your shoot with Ingrid Veniger, feature in Chile. When we last spoke, you covered as much prep and general theory you could, considering the unique approach to the production shooting process by the filmmaker.
Yeah, so, here we are like 4 months after our last conversation. I've been to Chile and back with Ingrid to shoot her feature film, which, when we last spoke, didn't have a title. We now have a title. It's called He Hated Pigeons. She also developed, I think since our last conversation, she had developed a bit of a script. The hopeful running time was going to be 75 to 80 minutes, and she basically came up with a very loose 55-page script, again, with the idea of keeping it a little bit free-form to kind of be able to explore what we found along the way.
Okay, so it was a naturalistic approach. It wasn't too stylized. Did that work out?
Yeah, that evolved a little bit. What I think, when I spoke before, I mean, there wasn't too much of a surprise. We were dealing with, again, the beauty of Chile and the variety of all of the different kind of topography, which ended up, you know, sort of making me feel that, especially with once I understood, started to understand what the film was about, made me understand that let's also use this landscape to our advantage. And at the beginning of the film, our main character is a little bit, I guess for lack of a better term, he's kind of a little bit lost at sea with his emotions. So I thought it would be fantastic to basically do a lot of wide shots and have him as the main character, very small in these shots. And again, I was starting to think projection, bigger screen, and that was a good way to kind of take advantage of what was being given to us by nature and also connected to the story somehow. We had spoke a little bit about this before we left as well, so that the film would actually then start to progress and become a little bit more intimate with him. And also, at the beginning, we wanted to kind of create the sense of him being dislocated from the environment, because without giving too much away of the story, essentially he becomes more connected to nature as the film progresses, as part of this journey that he's taking. So part of that was to show basically primarily landscape with this little guy, kind of, you kind of notice as
right,
a secondary
thing. The visual
thing.
Language of distance. And
yeah, and just like lost in the expanse of it all, and him fairly insignificant in this great beauty around him. And then when we shot closer shots of him driving, we intentionally kept the focus very shallow so that he was felt very disconnected from the environment outside. And then as we progressed further to the south and he starts to become a little more aware of his surroundings, we started to work with a little deeper focus. So for the driving shots, you could actually see what the stuff is outside a little bit more. We'd probably frame a little bit wider on some of the car shots so that he was
so
a little more...
it's involving the world.
Yeah, and right. and making him more connected to it. Whereas in a looser way earlier, it's just very, you know, he's sharp focus and there's just all this blurry stuff going past around him. And it just makes him feel really sort of disjointed from his environment. So... although we went in kind of with a naturalistic approach by nature of what the shoot was, this is, I think, what I was talking about before, about how I wanted to find ways of incorporating sort of the beauty of where we were and also create interesting imagery for the audience to look
right,
at.
Right, the visual narrative,
totally.
Which is what you're there for.
But also find a way to make it connected to the story. Because,
yeah.
Again, it doesn't just want to be pretty postcards. Yeah. That, you know. Although it's interesting because for the credit sequence, there are a whole series of beauty shots that Ingrid wanted. Partly because, in her mind too, this is a bit of a love letter to Chile as well. It's a celebration of the country itself as well. So it was an opportunity to... So, you know, we kind of exploited that a little bit for the credit scene, which is we had a whole series of, you know, times where we're like, okay, well, we got about an hour left. Why don't we just shoot some postcard shots? And we would run around and just get beautiful shots at magic hour and, you know, like all that kind of stuff. So that was a dream. That was
oh,
great.
Nice. Was it shot in sequence?
I would say, well, it's interesting. That's an interesting question because yes, it was. Essentially, the story is about him driving from the north end of Chile to the south end. So we were true to the geography for the most part. Although I just saw a rough cut last week, and as things evolve again, when the editing starts to happen, there are some scenes that kind of got tossed around a little bit. But I think in a really good way, like partly because some footage we saw shot in one area didn't kind of work as a complete scene unto itself, but there was some good footage there. And then another scene where we were kind of missing context of the environment, we were able to use the shots we took from the earlier, like a place that's 3,000 kilometers further north, and interject, because it's a town square. The town squares, remarkably, they all look the same down there.
Good few, okay.
Yeah, so basically she was able to kind of intercut those to kind of create more context around this one scene later. So although... Right. We theoretically kind of did shoot in order. There was a little bit of license there in the edit to kind of shuffle some stuff around.
No, that's good. I was sort of asking in the sense of sort of simplicity for the shoot, because it was a skeleton crew, and that if you're jumping out of sequence, it would have been a bit more challenging.
Yeah, well, no, and that came up as well because there were some complications. Like at one point, he chucks his shirt off of a cliff and. So now that we have him with no shirt and a jacket, so there were some continuity things, and where we shot that scene where he loses the shirt, we did actually have to shoot some scenes of him sitting on a beach where he's supposed to still have the shirt. So there was still some of that, not a lot of it, but oh my God, that, and even those little bits without having a continuity person and a wardrobe, like just keeping track of that stuff was kind of crazy. And I think there maybe one or two little continuity blips that the geeks out there can look for. But
okay, so... Now let's talk about the camera, because you were very intrigued by the light sensitivity.
Yeah.
And it was the Sony A7S.
That's correct. Yeah.
And you said you had the Canon 24-70.
Yeah.
And what other lens pack? What did you?
The 24-70, and then the Sigma, the Art lens, the 35mm prime that is a faster lens than the zoom that we used for any extreme low light stuff that we needed. We limited ourselves to just that one lens, the 35mm, because the 35mm with the speed booster. Which I think I mentioned in the earlier interview, essentially gives you a T1 lens to work with.
I was a little confused when I was actually re-listening. When you said it maxed out at 3200 ISO, and you said it was limiting for daylight?
Yes, so let me get into that. So basically when the camera is able to record S-log, but when you're in the S-log mode, you're limited to 3200 ISO.
That's it, one.
No, you can go... You can go up from there, but you can't go. You can't get the terminology. So you can't. It's the lowest ISO you can get. You can't go to 200 ISO.
Oh.
In S-log. 3200 is it? Or you can go 6400 or 12,000, but you can't go the other way.
Okay. So is there a mode to get out of that you could go lower?
You can get out of S-log, but the problem is with the trade-off is with S-log you get essentially more dynamic range. But with the limitation of only being able to shoot at 3200 ISO. So I ended up doing some testing because I was like, okay, well, I want to test, because the trick is generally where you need the most dynamic range is in the daytime. So that's when you really want to use S-log and you don't want to shoot at 3200 ISO. So I actually did get a really heavy ND, and I did a test where I did two of the same exposures, one at 3200 in S-log, and one at 100 ISO in a different setting called Cine Gamma 2, which I think I was mentioning in the earlier interview too, is kind of the preferred middle ground. And the sharpness, the grain, effectively the noise levels at the 100 ISO looked way better. So in my mind, it was, I'll deal with the dynamic range over getting a sharper looking image, because that was more important. I think there were maybe two, possibly three shots in the whole shoot where I actually went into S-log when I was in a situation where it was like, whoa, I really need shadow detail and I need to hold that highlight. So those shots come up pretty flat and will have to be more properly graded. Mm-hmm. But so shooting in the Cine Gamma 2, which was the setting I shot for most of the stuff with, allowed me whatever ISO I wanted. It obviously limited the dynamic range slightly. That said, it's still a great gamma curve. There was still lots of room. We actually took it into Deluxe and did a little test transfer, and our colorist Ryan there was great. He was like, this stuff is fine. I mean, I don't see any problem in grading from this. So that's kind of where we settled.
Oh, great. Now, was the main lens you had on was the zoom, the short zoom?
The zoom, and then for any of the low light stuff, I would use the Sigma lens.
Right. Okay, so it performed well.
It performed well. So but let me tell the one, because I you probably remember all my excitement about shooting in the full moon.
Yes, the movie. Yes, of course, we have to talk about.
So
the full moon.
the obviously one of the setbacks of working at this scale and having your lead actor being the location manager is that essentially we're showing up at locations without scouting them. We're relying on the person who's found this spot for us. My going into this, it was like this scene was going to take place in the Atacama Desert, where there are observatories, there are areas where that have never ever seen rain. So I just put the idea of weather out of my head. I was like, of course we're going to have a crystal clear sky. We're in the Atacama Desert. We get there. It's, you know, a friend of his who's set us up with a friend who's going to show us this place that's really cool to shoot this, you know, pretty pivotal scene about, you know, it's got to be cliffs. It's, there are certain aspects that had to be right for the look. And we get there and it's just stunning. It's unbelievable cliffs. But the problem is it's coastal. And so there's essentially a marine layer where, you know, the weather from the ocean is meeting the land. And right along the coast for probably, you know, a kilometer inland is this marine layer of overcast. And there's no opportunity to respond. I mean, all of our, the entire next 28 days, all of our accommodations are booked. All of our transport, ferry transport's been booked. There's no flexibility. We're here for two nights and we're gone. So either we're shooting tonight or we're not. So it was a little bit of a freak out. We were there at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon to shoot that evening. And I was like, is this going to go away? And it was like, yeah. So it was you know, one of those, and it was our first shoot night too, right? So it was a lesson learned early on that, wow, like, this is what we're into. It's a little bit of the Wild West. And so all of that said, night, you know, we kind of get into the end of day where it's starting to get darker. We're starting to look at some scenes and I'm getting the camera set up and I'm like, okay, this is not going to clear up. And we kind of went into this panic mode for about half an hour where we were like, oh my God, we might just have the next half hour to shoot the whole scene. Let's do it. So we started to kind of freak out a bit. And there was a little bit of irrational moment there, but then it finally got dark and I was like, okay, well, what time is it now? And somebody said, oh yeah, I know the sun went down about an hour ago. And I was like, okay, so this is it. So remarkably, the camera was able to capture an image with a layer of cloud and the full moon behind it. That, I say an image because initially I was really concerned after looking at the first night's footage at how noisy it was. I did expect it to be noisy, obviously. Long story short is, I looked at the rough cut last week. I've been back and forth with Deluxe about talking about doing some noise reduction to help the image along. But even seeing it last week, with the noise factor, it's actually taken on, and Ingrid, the director herself, has said she's been living with it for the last month and she loves it. Mm-hmm. It's got this very, I don't know how to describe it, it's a very eerie kind of feel to it, which is totally appropriate for the scene. And again, to the cameras, the amazing thing about that camera is that if we had any other camera there, we would not have been shooting that night. We would have had nothing to look at. There would have been a black image and there would be no exposure. The fact that this camera was able to record something that's in the ballpark of, you know, being able to be used. Oh my God, it's a godsend. So
was it seen more than your eye? Like, what did you see with your eye?
Absolutely. Yeah. Like I had to look through the camera to see what was being photographed. We had flashlights and stuff to kind of see each other. And obviously at a certain point, your eyes adjust. So you can kind of see shapes in that. But I was trying to actually take a photograph of the actual image and what was on the monitor so you could see the comparison because it's unbelievable.
So what is it, like infrared? Like how does it do that?
No, I mean, it takes what little light there is there and it's able to you know, get an exposure. It's amazing. I mean, the Sony chips in general, I think the Sony chips in general are moving that way. Like the F55 has always been kind of known as a really good low light camera. So I was blown away. I'm pretty worried for a few days, yeah. Even still looking at the stuff on my laptop, but wow. But like I said, it has also kind of become, it's helping to create the mood of that whole scene, which lives, which we come back to throughout the film. It becomes like a memory sort of flashback sequence as well. So it's a really great way of just letting the audience know immediately that you're there too. And there's, you know, the wind of the desert. So you see all this like,
oh, nice. It's happy accidents.
It is.
Starts out disastrous, but then in the end, it turns out to be so appropriate.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, again, I think it would have looked equally as stunning if we had a crystal clear sky with, like, because the big thing for me, as soon as I saw the topography, it was like, you know, with that really sharp, hard light of the moon, like cutting the shapes of those, like I was just so excited about how the full moon was going to look. So I think part of it for me too was just to process this very, it's almost like, you know, like that magic hour light where there are no mm-hmm. shadows. I mean, it's such a soft source. It's like such a unique looking light that, again, like I've never seen before, and that cameras in motion at least have never been able to capture before. So it's pretty unique. And she had a bit of a test audience with her too, and everybody was pretty blown away too. Nice. About the look. So
I can't wait to see it, you know.
In the end we're pretty happy.
Now, you had mentioned your lighting package was 1 3x12 Roscoe lighting pad. Did that hold up? Was that it?
I ended up buying this even smaller LED thing. It's made by a company called Rift Labs. I got it because it's pretty much about the size of an iPhone, a little LED puck almost, but it also can run off of a wireless app, and the app also lets you dial in whatever color of the rainbow you want. So if you want an effect like a red, you can dial in red. If you want tungsten daylight, it's really bright. It came with a little, probably 6-inch by 4-inch little soft box that you could put over it. And it was completely like charge it on your laptop, basically. So I used it maybe 3 or 4 times in the shoot. I almost want to say I didn't use any light because it pretty much didn't. But there were maybe 3 shots where I used that to replace an existing overhead light to make it a little more directional. And
so you had the little attachment with it?
Yeah, a little soft box that clips onto it.
Without it, was it harsh or?
It's pretty just like, it's just like it's a blam of LED light, pretty much. So, but yeah, that was it. I mean, otherwise it was interesting. I mean, basically using a lot of, there were a few scenes where we had to shoot, like in Santiago, we had a couple of night scenes and we shot essentially night for night outside. And again, I was blown away at how amazing that camera handled itself. That's it. I mean, I was only at about maybe 800 ISO for those nights, so I wasn't like pushing it like crazy. But having the fast lenses combined with, you know, some sodium vapor street lights, and I kept the daylight balance. I kept it at daylight balance, so it's sodium vapor and then some, so it's really
color.
Amber, like really beautiful looking stuff. And in addition, I used a glimmer glass diffusion filter for everything, partly because I wanted to kind of, you know, influence the look a little bit with that diffusion. For the night stuff, where it really helped was it essentially extended light sources. So a street light that on screen, if you measured it with your fingers, was like 1/4 inch big. As soon as you put the glimmer glass on, it kind of bleeds the highlights a bit, and that light source now becomes 1 inch on the screen. So the light source itself kind of becomes bigger, knowing that we weren't going to be using any lights. I just wanted to make sure I could kind of lift everything a little bit. It had a very slight low-con effect too, so it kind of bled in a little bit, and it just kind of imbued the kind of gritty night stuff with a little bit of, you know, something.
Nice.
Hard to describe, but yeah.
Now you had talked about some the workflow and what your theory of the workflow was, and there was concern about the sound and the syncing and the known time code, like, and for you as well. How did that?
Yeah, well, we ended up, we weren't able to lock the time code with the sound recorder and the camera. So what I just, every morning, I would reset the clock. So we were always within 5 seconds of each other. So that allowed for the editor, when it came to time to sync stuff. So she relied completely on Pluralize, which essentially analyzes 2 waveforms and then lines them up. So as long as the microphone isn't so far away from the camera that the camera sound that's being recorded to the clip, so the camera sound that's recorded on the clip and the sound that's being recorded by the microphone, as long as they're close enough together, they'll have a very similar waveform, and then that waveform can be lined up. And so we weren't really sure how well it was going to work, and talking to the editor, apparently it was seamless. It was it pretty much worked. And if the main thing was just knowing, because we weren't always rolling sound and image at the same time. Sometimes I would roll a few wild clips, so our clips were never lined up. So having the rough time code of at least within 5 seconds of each other, she could at least know, okay, this image clip belongs to this sound clip.
Right.
And then let Pluralize do the rest in terms of, you know, frame syncing.
So did Ingrid do anything at night to check things or?
on the road workflow was essentially, yeah, myself backing up all the video to hard drives. Then this Braden, our sound recordist, would do the same. He'd back up his stuff. We'd put it all in one folder. And then when we had time, she would have, we had our main drive and the backup drive. I would just always give her the backup drive at the end of each night, so she could either look at the footage herself or, yeah, if she had time. Just and yeah.
Two places that you want the, yeah, you want.
And exactly, keep them separated. Places. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So just a border question or just different countries, like taking the hard drives, you know, through customs, the borders, was there any issues?
No, I mean, we were
dangers, you know?
We were essentially traveling as tourists, you know, we weren't, which, you know, and there's no exaggerating that. I mean, we were making a film, but it's like, we're, you know, we it's not like we're three friends who are down there shooting footage with our friend from Chile. Like, it's not like we weren't like an official mm-hmm. that. And again, that's the, I think that's the advantage to her work approach as well. And why she, you know, one of the advantages to being able to keep the keep things the way they are is that you can kind of be a little more mobile in how you shoot that way. And that was evident also in just us shooting places and going and asking somebody if they wouldn't mind either being in the shot or getting out of the shot. We weren't this big production who was imposing. It was just, we were just some people on the street trying to capture some cool footage, you know.
So there was some sort of spontaneous grabbing people, grabbing shots, and did you get, because you were saying before that it was kind of out of your comfort zone working as in like a three-person crew.
Yeah.
And you were embracing it. Did it kind of live up to your expectations?
Yeah, I mean, it was the difficult parts for me were what I anticipated, which was the sort of focus pulling aspects, focus pulling off a DSLR. I had, thankfully, the last minute I picked up a little loop that could go onto my viewfinder on the back of the camera, which essentially acted as like a, onto the LCD screen, which essentially made it into like a viewfinder. Because I found, wow, like that was trying to get focus on that little screen.
It was no, like, with no shelter that. Around you
totally.
To focus.
So the loop saved me, and then also the focus assist, like the edge assist, I ended up using a lot. I also discovered some other problems along the way with the adapters I was using. The adapters are great, but they really mess with the back focus. They're not precision made. There was one scene that we shot and I learned the hard way. Like most of the stuff we were shooting was fairly controlled. The focus was fairly fixed. There was this one scene we had to shoot, speaking of this kind of thing, where we wanted our main actor to kind of be engaged with a group of people. We weren't sure what that was going to be. We ended up in this one place. There were these really cool Chileans who were on this camping trip. They were hanging out in their campground around a picnic table with a single light bulb over the picnic table. And Ingrid had gone over to them earlier as we were loading into our rooms. She said, "They're totally cool with us shooting them. Let's go." So I was like, "Okay, I got to get into full on doc mode here." And I, you know, and it was really, and it was like racing around the table, getting a whole variety of shots. And so I basically, I hadn't fallen back on this technique for the shoot until this time. This was probably 2 weeks in, where I would, you know, use the zoom lens, zoom in, grab focus, zoom out. Can't do that, and I learned the hard way. So any of the wider shots there are not in focus. Stuff where I, you know, where I zoomed in and grabbed it, it was fine. I stayed there, but you know, I was aware of all of these potential pitfalls. So at the end of every, like, I knew that I hadn't got those shots, 20 minutes after we shot them. So I was able to immediately kind of respond to that kind of stuff. So that kind of stuff was very difficult. And again, I don't really blame that on not having a crew. It's more, I think, just the difficulty of trying to shoot with a DSLR and shoot motion like that. And that's mm-hmm. something I've always known has been a problem with those systems. Mm-hmm. And it's just something you got to try to overcome.
Because it's not a totally full-on motion picture camera.
Yeah, they're not designed that way.
It's been adapted. It's been totally jerry-rigged. Because size and you know, the advantages it has.
Yeah, well, and the lenses aren't made, to do live zooms, for example. Like, there's too much image shaking when you try to move the elements, right? So they're not designed for that kind of photography. So, you know, you have to kind of be aware of those pitfalls.
So a few final questions. So did you think the project had the creative opportunities that you'd hoped for going in?
Yes, and then some, I would say. Although there were some negative aspects along the way, I was really pleased with the way the shoot went in general, in terms of that kind of approach of shooting, which I've never really done before. It was very liberating. It was very challenging, but there was so much, you kind of got back 10 times what you gave in for being able to just kind of go with the flow. Now, again, the other side of that is there's some great stuff that we ended up shooting that happened just magically. And we were all just like going, oh my God, I can't believe that. Just like, how did that work out at that time? That aren't in the film. Because that's the way it goes too. Sometimes, you know, you think it's cool at the time, but if it doesn't work with the story. But so I really enjoyed that aspect of it. That on top of the fact that, you know, you normally wouldn't be proud to say this, but we worked for 28 days straight. We never had a day off, but I couldn't have done it without this group of people. Like, we all got along so well. We were all so committed to the idea that it was a pleasure to work every day. It was hard. It was difficult. There were some days where we were like, really? Like, we drove 5,000 kilometers. We pretty much drove the length of Canada in the time we were there. So it was tough. And there were like, and these are like, a lot of it was not paved roads, man. And it was like, it was difficult. So I'm not saying it was easy, but it was definitely rewarding. And I think, you know, again, that's a testament to the people that were involved. And I think that was the coolest part of the experience and what I'd hoped it would be, which was that it was a good life experience. And along the way, we captured what I hope is going to be a fantastic movie as well. So
I think with that kind of shoot, with that approach, it can only work with a small group.
Absolutely, yeah.
You have no mutinies, because it's like you have to be committed, and there's energy amongst, like, you know, three, maybe four could work, but I totally agree that, you know, a small group works.
Yeah.
In reflection, would you have done anything different in your prep?
I think, you know, for me, the only thing was not being so adamant about things like locations, like the full moon thing, for example. Like, I think if I'd been more connected with the... I would have liked more the opportunity to have direct contact with who was doing locations, which, like I said, in this case, it ended up being our actor. Can you show me exactly on the map where we're shooting, and I want to know what the weather's going to be like? You know, I would have done that kind of due diligence if there was a proper location manager, but there was a bit of a conflict, so I don't want to be distracting the actor with exactly where we shoot. Whereas in hindsight, obviously, it's 2020. It's right. Like, I really wished we had been 10 kilometers inland from where we were. Because we actually did shoot some other locations that were just gorgeous, and I was thinking, oh my God, this could have worked beautifully as the spot for that to happen. And we're in the middle of the desert, and there's a perfectly clear sky. So that's really my only regret otherwise. I think, you know, maybe I would have probably done more due diligence with the lenses and the adapters leading up to it, so I was more aware of those limitations that I was describing. You know, I thought I'd kind of done my due diligence, not really having shot DSLRs like this before. But, yeah, obviously you learn stuff along the way, and that's part of what life experience is. And
now you're the expert.
I wouldn't say expert, but I'm definitely, I know way more than I did 6 months ago, for sure. And that was part of why I wanted to do it as well.
That's right. I mean, you never have control over everything. I mean, you never really know.
Yeah.
You could do all the prep you want, and something's always going to
absolutely
pop up.
Yeah.
And it'd be like, oh, and then you figure it out.
Yeah, and then again, like, there's happy accidents. Maybe in the end, maybe this look that we got with the overcast moon is actually better in the end. Like, we don't have the two to compare, but it's like, maybe this makes it a better, I don't know, we'll see.
This has been the Canadian Society of Cinematographers podcast. The CSC is a non-profit organization that has been promoting the art and craft of cinematography in Canada since 1957. Find out more by logging on to thecsc.ca. Thank you for joining us.